World News Today, brought to you by Continental Radio and Television Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations, as well as the leading news centers of our own country, CBS correspondents are waiting to bring you a complete report from the world's political and battlefronts. But first, here's John Daly.
At this week's beginning, Allied armies in Russia and North Africa are preparing for the second round of their great offensives. The Russian armies have consolidated their positions around Rostov and are now drawing the noose tight around that city. In Libya, with Tripoli in our hands, the 8th Army is smashing on toward Tunisia to join in the battle that is to clear the Axis out of North Africa. In the Pacific, the vicious air and ground fighting continues. The Navy Department gave out more news of that front only a half an hour ago. For that news, Admiral Radio takes you first to CBS Washington, Lee White reporting.
The Navy's just announced that American planes have carried out 7 bombing attacks in the Solomons in the last 2 days, doing heavy damage to the airdrome at Munda. The Japanese have again bombed our own installations on Guadalcanal and Espiritu Santo. The latest Army communique reports that the Germans have captured yet another strategic height in central Tunisia. If the military situation still seems unfavorable, the political situation seems to have gone from bad to worse. The State Department is under heavier fire than at any time since the North African campaign began. A few days ago, the Washington Post accused the State Department of bungling and demanded the removal of Robert Murphy, our chief political delegate. Then Walter Lippmann added his voice to the clamor. And today, Ernest Lindley, who has a reputation for being a State Department apologist, chided Messrs. Hull and Murphy in no uncertain terms for passing the political buck to the War Department and attempting to make General Eisenhower responsible for what he considers their mistakes. But that's not all. I.F. Stone, a Washington correspondent of the newspaper PM, charges that Paul H. Appleby resigned from the State Department as a protest against the appointment of the one-time Himmler of Vichy France, Marcel Peyrouton, as Governor General of Algeria. Mr. Appleby, a well-known food expert, was lent to the State Department by the Department of Agriculture to take charge of relief operations under Herbert Lehman. But according to PM, he couldn't stomach Peyrouton. London still reports rumors of momentous decisions, presumably emanating from Washington. And the same rumors are just as prevalent here, presumably emanating from London. A big story is about to break, and everybody's hoping it will entail a sensible moral solution to the North African problem, as well as the Joint Allied War Council referred to by Wendell Willkie today in his speech in New York. Vice President Wallace also spoke today, predicting a post-war America in which all men can become members of the middle class and share in the benefits with which that class has enjoyed in the past. After 13 months of war, Congress is now at last aroused over the growing shortage of labor, and manpower czar McNutt is being subjected to a barrage of criticism that he may not be able to withstand. Tomorrow, the Senate Military Affairs Committee will open hearings to determine why, at this late date, the War Manpower Commission still has no definite program. Senator Austin of Vermont says he and his colleagues will certainly draft a labor mobilization law unless Mr. McNutt can convince them that such legislation is unnecessary. A missing Panagra transport plane with 15 persons aboard has been sighted from the air in the jungles of Peru. A rescue party is now searching for possible survivors. J. Pierrepont Moffat, American minister to Canada, died in Ottawa today. I now return you to CBS New York and John Daly.
More news in just a moment. But first, here's Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
You are one of several million Americans now listening to news reports coming from all over the world by radio. Have you ever considered the part radio has come to play in your life? To most of us, radio is a necessity and a convenience. To American fighting men lined up on over 60 different battlefronts, radio is an absolute essential. It is often their only connection with headquarters and with other fighting units. It is the unifying link which makes coordinated action possible. Admiral has produced radios for both purposes, peace as well as war. In peacetime, Admiral radios were designed for performance and beauty, for the luxury of American homes. In fact, during peacetime, Admiral was the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonograph combinations with automatic record changers. Now, Admiral is producing radios for war. Radios which will link America's fighting units together. Radios which are sturdy enough to take all the grueling punishment of modern battle and still operate perfectly. Yes, Admiral has pioneered in the production of both the radio of war and the radio of peace. When victory has been won, and with it the blessings of peace, look again to Admiral for exciting new adventures in radio entertainment made possible by today's amazing wartime developments and discoveries. Tomorrow, as always, an Admiral radio will be America's smart set. Now, here once again for Admiral Radio is John Daly.
And now, more news of the Pacific. Organized Jap resistance in Papua has been ended by American and Australian troops. For the latest details, Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS Australia, William J. Dunn reporting.
The Japanese invasion of Papua, of Australian territory, lasted exactly one day over 6 months. On July 22nd, the first enemy convoy landed troops at Goona, almost without opposition. Saturday of the week just ended saw the last remnant of that ambitious force completely liquidated on the epitaph of some thousands of Japanese pinned in the brief communique sentence, "Ground fighting in Papua has ceased." The week just ended had witnessed the windup of one of the bitterest campaigns any contingent of green American troops has ever called upon to face. This campaign has been of inestimable value, both to the American and their Australian allies. In the months it took to drive the Japanese back across the Owen Stanley vein, isolate them, and finally wipe them out completely, the Allies have learned lessons which could be learned in no other way. As a result of this campaign, we now have military leaders who know this type of warfare, who have outsmarted the enemy in a type of fighting he himself developed, and who can, when necessary, lead fresh troops into jungle or mountain warfare with the confidence that comes only of knowledge. Lieutenant General Eichelberger, who led the American forces in the field before Bina and San Ananda, told me early in December that the greatest gain the Allies could hope for in the fighting gone underway was not so much the elimination of an enemy force as the invaluable experience we were then getting, and getting the hard way. Another Tokyo myth has been exploded, and the Allied soldier has emerged from the Papuan battle as a pretty fair jungle fighter in his own right. This is William J. Dunn in Australia. I return you to CBS in New York.
In Western Europe, British bombers are continuing their round-the-clock attacks on Nazi-occupied Europe. And Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS London, Bob Trout reporting.
From Britain, the Royal Air Force struck again last night at the German U-boat bases in the French Atlantic port of Lorient, the fifth attack on this U-boat base made during January, four of them made in the last 10 days. Lorient had not had time to recover from yesterday's daylight attack by liberators and flying fortresses of the USAAF, when the RAF bombers were over the port in the moonlight. High explosives and incendiaries, dropped for 20 minutes, started very heavy fires. The men and women of Britain's home front, who know pretty well what this war is about, have, as you know, not been happy about the political muddle in North Africa. This has nothing to do with General Eisenhower, and no responsible person in Britain has ever said it had. What it's about is the basic purpose of this war. Britain's ordinary men and women quickly saw, even last November, that what happens in North Africa is bound to be a small-scale preview of what will happen all over Europe. They didn't like that preview much. The state of affairs exemplified by North Africa is definitely not what they made up their minds long ago they're fighting for. In recent days, the British people have been getting hints that the North African affair is going to be cleared up and, properly, done as part of a large understanding between Great Britain, Russia, China, and the United States. The four nations, so the hints go, are planning something approaching a general Allied war council. Curiously enough, the British newspapers attributed these hints to sources inside the United States. And, I suspect, the United States hears that the hints are coming from London. This weekend, the transatlantic rumor barrage reached its climax, in London at any rate, and today's papers are talking about vital decisions, which will soon be announced. Obviously, it's the kind of thing which is not to be talked about too much until the announcement is made. But just in case you have the impression that all Britain knows a secret which the United States does not know, I'll read you the screaming headline from London's Sunday Pictorial, one of Britain's few tabloids. In huge letters, it says, "Big news soon, says America." Next to CBS Cairo and the report of Winston Burdett.
The bulk of the Africa Corps, considerably the worst for wear but still an intact fighting force, was falling back into southern Tunisia today while British forward troops were shooting it out with Axis rear guard somewhere along the coast road between Tripoli and Douala. The 8th Army already was well on its way down the last 100-mile stretch of highway between Tripoli and the Tunisian border. Already British and American fighter bombers are flying from air drones in the Tripoli area, where the Luftwaffe was operating less than a week ago. Naval and Army engineers have begun work on Tripoli Harbor, getting it back into shape for the convoys which will help supply the 8th Army's next full-scale effort on a battlefront somewhere in Tunisia. Tripoli is a trump card which will resolve many of the supply problems with which the British have been struggling ever since they hit west from Egypt. The Africa Corps in southern Tunisia will also enjoy some new advantages. It will be linked with von Arnim's army in the north by a modern road and rail system. It will stand a better chance of getting reinforcements than it did when it was fighting in the wilderness of Tripolitania. The German command will likewise be able to transfer arms and men from front to front, according to where they are most urgently needed. Von Arnim's army has been consistently strengthened during the past week and is now reported to comprise 2 armored and 1 infantry division, apart from Italian troops. Taking advantage of wet weather, Rommel may prefer to make a stand in the low marshes skirting Gabes Bay rather than in the fortified Maref zone. Somewhere, certainly, he must fight, whether he picks his battlefield in the swampy south or seeks to join up with the Pink Panther Army in the north. In any case, the 8th Army has an appointment in Tunisia, a rendezvous with General Eisenhower's forces, and General Montgomery means to make all haste to keep that rendezvous. I return you now to CBS in New York.
Again, we turn to the Pacific, this time for an eyewitness story of the recent American raid on Jap-held Wake Island. Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS Honolulu, Webley Edwards reporting.
Before Christmas, a large flight of United States Army bombers roared through the moonlit skies of the Central Pacific, heading for historic Wake Island, with orders to demolish Jap installations there. And straight and true, they headed for their target, the little island rocking with explosion after explosion. And when the raid was over, Wake Island's installations were a flaming ruin, and the American planes came home almost without a scratch, all personnel present and accounted for. In fact, they had one extra man. And thereby hangs the tale of a man who stowed away on a bomber. I have him with me right here in Honolulu. Sergeant, give us your full name and hometown.
Technical Sergeant Paul W. Sweetheart, sir. Hometown, Tilson, Kansas. My folks live there now.
Why does a man stow away on a bombing plane, Sergeant Sweetheart?
Because I wanted to see action. I thought I'd been waiting about long enough, so I thought I'd see if I couldn't go along somehow.
You figured this all out in advance?
Well, not too far. I was crew chief on one of the planes, Tilly the Wack. We take care of the planes after every flight. We check them over before they go out to make sure they come back. If there's anything wrong with them, we fix them up.
The ground crew really lives that slogan, keep them flying, then.
A fellow gets to thinking when he takes care of a plane that it's almost his baby. Some of the boys get the feeling that we loan the plane to the pilot and navigator when they take it out.
So when you heard something was up, I guess you're pretty busy.
I'd been grooming the ship to see whether everything was okay. I was in and out of the plane 15 or 20 times. I got to thinking I'd sure like to stick with that plane. I knew that the plane could safely carry a lot more poundage, even for a long distance.
Did you know where the raid was headed?
No, but I knew that it would be a big one. So the last time I went in the plane, I took my parachute and Mae West along. Well, my job when the plane takes off is to see that the props are clear and to watch the engine from behind. I went up front and gave a pilot the high sign that everything was okay. Then I ran back and went in the rear of the plane and hit. Everybody was up forward, and I made it without being spotted. I stayed put for a while until we were well up. Then I came out of hiding. The crew was quite surprised to see me.
To say the least. What'd they do?
The tail gunner saw me and asked, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm going along." And he said, "Looks like you are." But Lieutenant Samuel Gregory, the pilot, and all the crew were pretty nice about it. I made myself useful wherever I could. I transferred into this outfit hoping I'd get to be a gunner. And I figured if any of the boys got hurt, I could take their place. Fortunately, nobody got hurt, but I was ready.
Well, what happened when you got back, Sergeant Friot?
I was plenty worried. After we landed, I got busy checking the plane, and nobody said anything for a while. But I caught it later on. The colonel didn't punish me, but I and everybody else was given to understand that it hadn't better happen again.
And that's the story of Sergeant Paul Tweedock, who stowed away on the big Wake Island raid by United States Army bombers. Ladies and gentlemen, there will be no more stowaways on Army bombers. I'm advised by Colonel William A. Matheny, Group Commander, that strict orders have been issued against the possibility of any stowaways in any future operations. And other commanding officers have done the same. But this story, and it's a good one, adds proof to the intense eagerness of the young men in our armed forces out here to get into action. This is Webley Edwards in Honolulu. We'll return you to CBS in New York.
Russia's noon communique, general rather than specific in its claims, announced that several more populated places were taken in the Voronezh area and that the Red Armies in the North Caucasus have taken a town of great strategic importance after an advance of 13 miles. Thus, the armies of South Russia closed the Iron Ring around Rostov. The capture of Armavir announced yesterday puts the Russians 110 miles south of the city, astride the main rail line running right into Rostov. Another Russian army is moving up the Manch River Valley towards Rostov and is only 80 miles away. In addition, north and northeast of the city, other Red Armies are steamrolling over German defenses, are only 56 to 90 miles from Rostov, and have already taken most of the rail communications which the Germans needed to maintain isolated forces in the Don Valley. The recent developments in the Caucasus have completely unhinged the German defenses, and the Nazi forces in the Maikop oil region are in danger of being cut off, as were the 22 divisions at Stalingrad. One of the most important bits of news out of Russia today affects the Axis force trapped at Stalingrad. The Russian communique reported that a German battalion surrendered en masse, in spite of the tales of torture and death for prisoners taken by the Russians spread by the German officers. This development may well mean that the entire Axis force remaining may surrender in the near future, thus releasing many Russian divisions for the offensives against Rostov and Kharkov. The German communique describing the fighting in Russia is full of evasive phrases. It speaks of shortening the southern front according to plan and says that the fighting in the northern Caucasus has shifted to the Kuban Plain, which is an obvious roundabout way of saying that the German armies in that area are retreating just about as fast as they can. In describing the plight of the Axis force trapped at Stalingrad, the communique falls all over itself. It says that the Axis positions there became intensified through further breaches by strong Russian masses from the west, but at the same time, it said that the defenders held unbroken. The Russians say that of the 220,000 men of the German 6th Army originally trapped at Stalingrad, less than 40,000 remain. In Chicago, in the former Hotel Stevens, our Air Force is training men in the technical aspects of their part of the war. And for a report from this headquarters, Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS Chicago, Bill Slocum, Jr. reporting.
It has been my lot in recent weeks while the boys in New York were checking the signal from Algiers to do brief and often unintelligible little masterpieces from strange places, such as submarines, paratroop planes, and patrol planes, but never from so unusual a spot as the scene of this epic. I'm standing on a balcony, a gold one, too, and above me are some gleaming crystal chandeliers, and below me are 600 or 700 hungry men packing away their dinner with some grace and unbelievable enthusiasm. They are all soldiers learning the art of radio transmission and reception at the Army Air Force's Technical Training Command's Unit Number 1, Chicago, which was once the Stevens, the world's largest hotel. When the Army took over the Stevens August 1st, every bit of luxury equipment was moved out in 13 nights. It took 1,000 vans to move it all, and as quickly as a room was cleared, it was refurnished with what the Army insists are beds. No fewer than 2 double-deckers in any room, and as many as five or six in the suites. During the recent Democratic conventions, the Stevens was CBS News headquarters, so I was sure nothing would surprise me in this hostelry. But the picture of a squad of steel-helmeted soldiers marching out of an elevator set me back, although I could not quite erase the thought that we could have used them in those hectic convention days. They can feed 5,000 students thrice daily in this mess hall, which was once the grand ballroom. It's a sort of a perpetual mess hall, because here at the Stevens, men sleep while others study. Downstairs in the huge exhibition halls, there are now 24 radio mechanics classrooms with laboratories installed around the outside walls. The coffee shop is the post exchange restaurant, and the flower shop is now the provost marshal's office. Up on the third floor, there are even more classrooms. The job the Army Air Forces is doing here is a tough one. Thousands, and I can't tell you how many thousands of youngsters are being taught ROM, which means radio operator mechanic. That means they can make radios work, no matter whether they are sending the signal from the towers of Bowling Field in Washington or from a bouncing B-25 over Tokyo. They have so many embryo radio men here that the Chicago Park Commission built an overpass over Michigan Boulevard in front of the hotel. It seems the unending stream of soldiers crossing the Bull Mich to drill tied up traffic in all directions. There are lots of women in the hotel because as much of the staff as possible was kept, and many of the teachers are girls. I asked Brigadier General Albert L. Sneed, in command of the vast schooling set up here, how these boys, most of whom never saw the inside of an airplane, felt about the hazards of flying compared to the comparative safety of ground and tower operations. They all want action, he told me. They want to get into planes. They work hard here, and they're anxious to get out. They want to fight. I return you now to CBS in New York and John Daly.
And now Admiral Radio brings you Columbia's military expert, Major George Fielding Elliott.
One of the most important questions which remains unanswered at this moment is the remaining striking power of Marshal Rommel's famous Africa Corps as it withdraws into Tunisia. It will find awaiting it strong defensive positions covering the approaches from Tripoli into Tunisia, the famous Marath Line. On this line, Rommel may be able to make a stand with his infantry units, leaving his mobile elements free to operate behind the line in southern and central Tunisia to protect the east coast ports of Gabis, Sfax, and Sousse, on which he depends for supplies and reinforcements, and to cooperate with the Durban forces already in Tunisia to clear a wider space for maneuver and gain greater depth for defense.
And now Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
During the next few weeks, Admiral dealers expect to be swamped with calls for radio service. Radio will become more important than ever to the home. Wage earners will want all possible information on the new income tax report they must file, and housewives will want to keep abreast of point rationing, especially as to the constantly changing point values of the various foods. People know they'll depend on their radios for such information, yet many, whose radios aren't performing as well as they should, won't call their Admiral dealer for service until the last minute. We'd like to advise you to call your Admiral dealer now. He's still able to get replacements for most parts, and his skill is unquestioned. Almost any radio, regardless of make or condition, can be made as good as new by your Admiral dealer quickly, so you won't miss your favorite programs, and economically, so your budget won't be upset. Above all, don't try to repair your radio yourself. And don't put it in the hands of an unskilled person. One little slip, and you may be without a radio for the duration. Be sure. Call your Admiral dealer. Get the job done right. This week, Americans everywhere are uniting to stamp out infantile paralysis. Don't neglect making your contribution. You won't if you remember that tomorrow's America will be as strong as today's children. Help make America strong. Give generously to the campaign to fight infantile paralysis. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Continental Radio and Television Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from the leading news centers of the world. Warren Sweeney speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is the WBBM Air Theater, your station in the Wrigley Building, Chicago.